Hey folks, today's episode is sponsored by my favorite sponsor, that is SunsetLakeSabade.com. Go there for 20% off. Left is best. I was out the week of 420, but Sunset Lake raised $4,000 from the 420 sale that will go to the Innocence Project. This is par for the course for these guys. They are movement partners, a great company. They have supported unions and charities like Give Directly and soup kitchens. And this Innocence Project donation is just one more example. And they have a great product. Tinctures, gummies, Sabade fudge, and coffee. They have salves. Apparently, I'm the only person who pronounces it that way. Salves with arnica and Sabade. And not only does their tincture get me to bed, apparently somebody sent me an article from the Washington Post saying that the way that people respond to after workouts is all wrong. And one of the things they're suggesting is for people to take Sabade afterwards. And Sunset Lake has the goods, folks. They use integrated pest management, no pesticides, organic fertilizer. They use regenerative farming practices. They have great business practices. They have a fantastic product. You can check the integrity on the website. They have third-party breakdowns of everything that's in there. There's a lot of bad product out there, but you will not find it at SunsetLakeSabade.com. Checked it out. Left is best. They chose the coupon code a couple of years ago, fans of the show, for 20% off. And hit them up on Twitter. Thank them for raising money for the Innocence Project. Okay, now, time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 29th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. On the program today, Ari Ravenhoff, former advisor and deputy campaign manager to Bernie Sanders, on his new book, The Fighting Soul, On the Road with Bernie Sanders. Also on the program today, Joe Biden seeks $33 billion in Ukraine aid, most of that military aid. And that's on top of the Lend-Lease legislation passed by the Senate. Meanwhile, the New York State Court of Appeals, top court in New York State, that this issue can go to anyways, voids New York's congressional maps. This is going to have huge, not just state, but national consequences in terms of Democrats' opportunity to save the House in November. Meanwhile, U.S. announces it will support NATO membership for Sweden and Finland. Biden considering some student loan forgiveness. Oklahoma passes a six-week abortion ban based on the Texas bounty hunter law. California is suffering a mega drought. May spark blackouts this summer. Meanwhile, also in California, its attorney general is investigating fossil fuel and petrochemical industries for deceiving the public over plastic waste. Meanwhile, Moderna seeks FDA authorization for under 6-year-olds getting a vaccination. And the House January 6th committee to hold primetime hearings in June of this year. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Casual Friday. As you can see, I am wearing my soft-collared shirt, and Emma Vigeland is here wearing no collar on her shirt.
No collar. That is my way, right?
Collarless.
Yes. That's.
It's a race to the bottom.
Fair enough. Let me get my, sorry, just going to get my thing going there. Emma, here we are. It is Friday. It's
yes,
my
it
first
is.
Week back after
How's
I'm still a little bit out of sorts. But I am close to, I am, I would say I am now like around 90%.
Yay. There we go. That's
so,
good.
I am climbing back from my COVID, haze and exhaustion and, et cetera, et cetera. We got a lot to get to today. I want to talk about this, story that was in the HuffPost, been sent by a number of people. First, it was sent, by a, mega fan. He knows who he is of the show, a story in HuffPost about a major alt-right figure who just disavowed white nationalism. And we got a mention in that piece.
Yes.
We'll talk about it later in the program. But before we get there, this has been something that we've been talking about for, obviously prior to Joe Biden getting elected to the White House. During the campaign, Joe Biden promised debt relief for the first $10,000 of Americans who hold student debt. And that's about 45 million people. And the first $10,000 you would hit, 45 million people would save $10,000. Now, you could go up to $50,000 or $60,000 easily for a lot of people as well.
But he won't do that.
He will not do that.
He's not considering it, even though that's what Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren were kind of pushing him
well,
for.
We have audio of him saying that very thing. Let's hear it.
Leader Schumer said yesterday that you're, quote, getting closer to using executive authority to cancel up to $50,000 in student loan debt. Can you confirm that? What exactly are you looking to plan to do here in the coming?
You mean my spokesman said that?
Majority Leader Schumer.
Look, number one, first thing we did was reform the system that was in place that didn't work for anybody, that allowed people to write off debt if they engaged in public service. We have almost 1,785,000, don't hold me the exact number, I'll get the number, 700 and some thousand have had debt forgiven, their whole debt forgiven because of their work, working in either as teachers or other means by which they qualify. And we continue to make that easier. Secondly, I am considering dealing with some debt reduction. I am not considering $50,000 debt reduction, but I'm in the process of taking a hard look at whether or not there will be additional debt forgiveness, and I'll have an answer on that in the next couple of weeks.
How high are you looking at?
So the real question, it seems to me, is going to be, you know, not necessarily the dollar figure, although that's hugely important, but whether it's going to be means tested and how much that is going to be larded up. The idea of, you know, how are they going to deliver this? And that is the big issue to me. I mean, I never thought that he would do $50,000. And the question is, will he do 10 or 20? And most importantly, avoid that sort of trap that Democrats seem to always fall into, in that they have to somehow justify this by people's, you know, poverty or lack of income. The idea is you can do this very easy. Everybody gets some debt relief, and then you move on past it rather than making, you know, sort of everyone upset.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it seems like there are forces within his administration they're trying to get him to do. I mean, I think he's also inclined to think like this, too, is let's tailor it. Let's make sure that it's not a broad proposal, because when you do when you implement a proposal that applies to everybody, then these young people might start to get an understanding that you can do broad-based solutions to a lot of ailments in society. And so if you make it specific for this kind of income threshold, say if you make under $60,000, but if you make $60,001, you're not going to get it. You know, that's what they're inclined to do, unfortunately, in my opinion. And it's going to make everybody mad, and it's not going to help them electorally.
And it's going to just be it complicates matters so much. Are you going to do a percentage of the debt in, you know, relative to their income? I mean, or is it just going to be, we're going to do $10,000 for anybody regardless of how much debt they have? I mean, if I'm making $60,001, but I have $75,000 worth of debt, that's very different than me making $50,000 and having only $15,000 worth of debt. I mean, the bottom line is, and I think to a certain extent, it is also a function of just, you know, fear. It is like classic Democratic Party fear and a delusion that if they somehow means test it, it's going to be, they're going to get attacked for it less. Go for the policy that you want, go bold and defend it, because it is a popular bill. And certainly, let's put it this way, the people who get debt relief are going to be far more enthusiastic about the issue one way or another than the people who don't.
Yeah, I read this, and now I'm trying to find it on the show the other day. There was this tweet that kind of went viral of a young person saying, if Biden cancels debt, I'll hang a picture of him like JFK, if like a Catholic hangs a picture of JFK in their house. I mean, that's true. You can endear yourself, if you go bold, to the voting population that's our age or even a little bit older, a little bit younger, by going broad strokes as opposed to just continuously, you know, stabbing yourself in the back by trying to means test it. It reminds me of Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the Democrats pushing for COBRA extensions during the pandemic as opposed to temporarily expanding Medicare. Because if you do something more bold, if you do something broader, there's going to be an understanding that you can do that more often, and you don't want to give people that idea. That's a little dangerous for us. But if you means test it, if you make it a bit more complex, if you make it tailored, then it's a little more specific and narrow. And so I hope those forces don't win out, because it's bad for Democrats electorally, and it's also just bad policy.
All right. We're going to have Ari Ravenhoff on in just a moment. First, a couple of words from our sponsors. But before we do, folks, it is your time to go and get tickets at Majority Live. The Boston show is about just a little more than 2 weeks away. We still have some seats left. There's actually, like, I noticed, like, probably like a half a dozen really good seats left. And at the Wilbur Theater, there are no bad seats. We got people flying in for this. And I will tell you, you will regret it if you don't come. We got special guests. We have activists. We have policy people. We may have a debate with a right winger that I think some people are familiar with on this show. One that has been a long time in coming. More on that. Go to majoritylive.com. Get your tickets for the Wilbur Theater, May 15th, 2 p.m. And also, as always, this show relies on its members. We're working out different ways. Maybe we might be, you know, people have noticed that we've started to separate the live streams of the fun half and the first half of the program. And we're looking at different mechanisms in which to drive our membership. And you can help support this program. We've talked about some of the challenges that this year has presented, ones that we didn't expect, ones that are sort of like cyclical in nature based upon, you know, the nature of a show about politics. But you can help keep this show alive and thriving by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you get the free show free of advertisements. Speaking of which, I don't know if you run a business. I guess I sort of do. I don't know. You can supercharge your knowledge of that business, your sales, and your success all with Shopify. It is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. We use Shopify for our merch sales, which are helpful, and people should check it out. Go to what is our merch website? I can't even remember now. Nobody? Good job. Well, we do a really good job of this. But I will say this. The site
shop.majorityreportradio.com.
Shop.majorityreportradio.com. I think we also have a URL for it. But the bottom line is we are powered by Shopify. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources that were once reserved for big businesses. So it doesn't matter if you're upstart or startup or a podcast, your established business, you can sell everywhere. You can synchronize your online and in-person sales and effortlessly stay informed. Shopify powers millions of businesses from first sale to full scale. You can reach customers online. You can reach them across social networks. They have an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps. It includes Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, even more. Plus, you gain insights as you grow. It gives you detailed reporting of conversion rates, of profit margins, and more. It is more than a store. Shopify grows with you. This is possibility powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/majority right now. Shopify, Shopify.com/majority. Also, we have a new sponsor. You should check this out. You can get a free trial at aura.com/majority. What is Aura? It is the way to protect yourself from the fastest growing crime in America, and that is identity theft. It happens to 1 in 20 Americans. And despite this, people seem to be shocked when their identity gets stolen. It can happen in numerous different ways. Okay. Imagine you're trying to log into your email account. You see the password has changed. I know folks that has happened to. You start getting notifications of activity from your bank, your credit cards, your crypto accounts, whatever it is. And that's when, of course, you get start feeling panic. You get fear. You got anxiety. You got paranoia. You got disbelief, shock, anger, frustration, guilt. You blame yourself. Maybe you got caught in a phishing thing, or maybe it's just like some your email and password were compromised on some other site and you didn't know about it. And they figured out how to break into other sites. That's why I'm excited to partner with Aura. They are sponsoring this program today. Aura is identity theft protection. It is fraud monitoring, has a VPN, has password management, and antivirus all combined into one easy-to-use app. Aura monitors the dark web for your emails and passwords and social security numbers and sends alerts fast right to your phone and email. I have multiple email accounts, and I'm running them through to see, and it's telling me it got compromised, that this email address got compromised there, this email address got compromised there, so that I can get a sense of like which passwords I should change. It really is incredible. And it gives you a sense of what other people are searching for you online too. When it comes to fraud, every second matters. You connect your credit card and bank accounts and you get notified of any changes up to 4 times faster than any of Aura's competitors out there. Their VPN allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. Their antivirus software will block malware and viruses before they infect your devices. And you can toggle any of these services on or off. You can protect your family from America's fastest growing crime. Try Aura for free for 2 weeks. See if any of you or your family's personal information has been compromised. This is really helpful to check this out and get a sense of, like, do you need a password overhaul? And then on top of that, the thing that is also sort of a revelation to me is their, I don't know what you call it, the password. They basically have password management. And so I no longer have to have my entire sheet of encrypted handwritten passwords. I know, I'm a boomer. Right now, you can start your free trial at aura.com/majority. That's aura.com/majority. Check it out. And lastly, one of our longtime sponsors, one of my favorite products. I'm talking about Quip. Quip gets your smile ready. It makes good habits easy with all the essentials you need to care for your mouth. That's the thing I realized about Quip at one point. Everyone in my family has a Quip toothbrush. And I'm not just talking my kids. I'm talking my sister. My sister had her dentist give her a compliment based upon the Quip toothbrush. Quip has an electric toothbrush. It uses timed vibrations, 30-second pulses to guide your dentist recommended 2-minute clean. It is loved by over 7 million mouths. Very, very helpful for the kids, but also for adults. Give you a sense of how long you should be brushing. Now, for me, I will do 4 minutes because I am very uptight about this. You can also upgrade now with a new smart motor to track and improve your brushing and earn sweet rewards. So it ties in with your phone. You build your whole routine with even more Quip, like the reusable floss pick, which is amazing. I can't even tell you. It's my favorite device that exists is their reusable flosser. Plus, they have refillable mouthwash, so you're not going through a bunch of plastic stuff, and they send it to you on a monthly basis. On top of that, Quip delivers brush heads, fresh floss, and other refills every month from just $5 a month. There's no extra shipping costs. Check it out. I've been using Quip for years. I love it. I have multiple toothbrushes because I went and I got the all black because I thought it was just cool looking. If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you're going to get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. That is spelled GETQUIP. Getquip.com/majority. Quip, it is the good habits company. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ari Rabinhoff. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the former deputy campaign manager of the Bernie Sanders campaign and author now of his second book, if I remember correctly.
Fourth.
The Fighting Soul on the Road.
Fourth?
What?
Fourth.
Oh, boy. I missed two. I'm sorry,
man.
No problem. Try hard. Seriously.
Ari Ravenhoff, the author of The Fighting Soul on the Road with Bernie Sanders. Ari, welcome back to the program. I'm here Emma.
Thank you, Emma, for having me.
Of course.
So congratulations on this. It's getting great reviews. It is. I have just started reading it. I am so psyched to get a sense of this. It is always, I love campaign books, particularly ones that I experience from one side to get a sense of what's going on behind it. But let's just give us a sense, just a background as to like how long you've been working for Bernie Sanders. And just, I mean, were you a body person? Like, I mean, just give a sense of how much you have traveled with Bernie Sanders over the past.
He did have another body person. Actually, we had several throughout the course of the campaign. And trip directors. But I, part of my role as deputy campaign manager was kind of dealing with everything that, and supervising everything that involved Bernie on the campaign. And therefore, I had to spend a substantial amount of time on the road with him. And prior to the campaign, when staffs are smaller, when I was deputy chief of staff in the Senate office, you know, part of my job was to work on kind of the outreach from the Senate office, which included going out on the road. So I spent basically 3.5 years straight traveling with him by his side in the Senate office, where I was also legislative director at different points, and working very closely with Bernie. I came to him after the 2016 campaign. I actually started working for him in January 2017. And we just grew very close from having been on the road. And I really wanted to give people a sense of that. I feel like Bernie's one of these historic figures who, you know, he'd really not like this description, but he is one of the most famous people in the world. We had there was a button on the campaign that we used on the advance and on the road staff to signify kind of you could go backstage, you could go into his room. And it was the outline of Bernie's head and glasses. And even that pin is recognized around the world. It's not even his face. It's just an outline of messy hair and glasses, and everyone knows that's Bernie. You have someone that significant, but I'm one of the few people who actually got to know him, actually got to see him up close, actually got to experience who he is. And I thought it was really important for history to have an account and have a book that actually focused on who is this incredibly important historic figure.
Were you had worked in the Senate prior to working for Bernie. How quickly were you surprised? Because one of the things that I think is important about this, you know, sort of perspective on him is that really atypical of a senator in terms of disposition of how he got there, and you know, from where he came, but also like the way that he viewed himself in the world as a senator. Like, how surprised were you, having been around other senators, having worked for other senators, you know, and you know, you worked for Harry Reid, who was certainly not like, you know, your sort of classic, you know, multimillionaire who comes into the Senate from, you know, having gotten money from his parents and that type of thing. But how surprised were you by Bernie's perspective on being a senator and just the way he moved the world?
Interestingly, I kind of viewed, and there are a number of senior Reid, senior Bernie staff connections, actually. It was a fairly common trajectory. But and part of that is, I feel like Bernie Sanders and Harry Reid were almost opposite sides of a similar coin, both of whom's kind of place in the world, both of whom's disposition in the Senate was very much based on a class consciousness because of how they grew up. But they took it, as you said, in very different directions, both somewhat ideologically, but also in their disposition. Bernie is an outside player. He doesn't like the Senate. He doesn't schmooze. He also, look, Harry Reid went home to Nevada after law school and kind of began a trajectory up to his path. Bernie was, you know, most senators have been working at being senators for much of their lives, even before they were a senator. They kind of were the kid who was the head of the Democratic Club in college and, you know, worked their way up that chain. Bernie never really did anything traditional to become a senator before he was a senator. He certainly never planned on running for president. Something I quote in the book, him saying to me repeatedly, is my parents would think I'm crazy if I told them I was going to become a senator or I was had a possibility of becoming president. You know, he's just not that. And in some ways, the fame, and I try to really get into this in the book, was almost uncomfortable for him and almost funny. There's a scene I put in the book where we are driving across the front of the Capitol and we're at a red light. And there's a tour going on of high school kids, and they look into this small, tiny car, and there's Bernie Sanders sitting in the front seat. I'm in the back seat. There's somebody driving, and they just start screaming like it's the Beatles, loud, like, "Oh my God, Bernie Sanders!" And he rolls down the window, and he's letting them take selfies, and he's giving them five, and he's shaking hands. And the light changes. He's like, guys, gotta go. Very busy, gotta go. And he rolls up the window, and we pull off, and he turns around to me. He's like, "I'm like Mick Jagger." And it was like this moment that, like, first off, that's his humor, right? He's clearly joking, but it's this like weird discomfort with, for seven decades of his life, he wasn't famous. He, you know, he was mayor, but Burlington is like a tiny city of 40,000 people, right? I think it's the smallest big city in America kind of deal. And then he was a House member and a senator who was known on the left, certainly known probably among the Majority Report audience, known among progressive radio and listeners, because for most of the time there was no progressive television at all. And no, I mean, Sam, we go back, we're old, and we go back to the day where there was no progressive media. But he was known kind of among the progressive audience, but he wasn't famous. Now, as I said, anywhere you go in the world, people know Bernie. And I think that's somewhat awkward for him.
Let's talk about the campaign. Or before we get to the 2020 campaign, give me a sense of how much insight you had to Bernie's perspective on the 2016 campaign.
A lot of insight, because he would, in preparation for the 2020 campaign, there were lots of conversations about 2016.
About what needs to be done differently?
Not just what needs to be done differently, what he was ultimately always talked about and what he kind of focused on a lot himself was, he would say, like, how do we create the magic? How do we create this world where he'd be like, you know, guys, you can do the technical stuff, but we got to create the magic, right? Mm-hmm. And for him, the magic was the big crowds, the energy, the excitement, kind of that intangible quality that he brings. And what's interesting about Bernie, he never realized that he was the magic, right? He never realized that it was a personal quality about him that voters were drawn to. And he'd push that off. You know, for him, it's so much about issues and everything else is just gossip.
Yeah, I just have a quick question, though, about that. I didn't mean to cut you off, but the difference between the 2016 and 2020 campaigns. I mean, working on his campaign with him, did you notice internally that there was an understanding that 2016 was a moment where I feel like a lot of people wanted somebody who was going to break up the system, break up the establishment, and we went very dark in that way with Donald Trump, and Bernie came close, but he ended up not winning in 2016. And in 2020, the pandemic, plus the shock from Trump's presidency, created a very different political environment for Bernie. Was there within the campaign an understanding, but a different tactical approach given those wildly different, I think, political environments in each time that he ran, even though it was 4 years apart?
Yeah, first off, Trump definitely created a hugely different environment. And the pandemic, which was kind of the end of the campaign, also kind of created a different environment. After you got past Super Tuesday, it really shaped the entire universe. But to your question, I think there were a few different tactical things. One, there was a real recognition that we couldn't just launched last time, the 2016 campaign. He walked outside the Capitol, walked up to a group of reporters on the lawn. There was like, I'm running for president. I got to go do other work now. Right. And he kind of turned around and walked back into the Capitol building, and he was running for president. This time there was the recognition that there was no ramp up time, that, you know, then nobody had any expectations of Bernie. Now there was an expectation that right away, you know, we'd have to have 10,000 person plus rallies. The amount of money we raised, if we didn't raise, you know, a huge amount of money, it would be a letdown. If we weren't moving, there was no time to like slowly build up. We had to have a fully functional campaign, a fully functional communications operation, and a candidate ready to be out there. In fact, we did before he even decided to run, we used October, and I talk about this in the book. We did this 25-event, 8-day stretch in October to just test our own abilities to do this and test his ability and kind of put everything through the paces. He hadn't decided to run yet, but like, we need this opportunity at the end of 2018 to go out with candidates, do big rallies, see what he's doing, see if we can kind of test our stuff here. And there was a recognition that there was no ramp up time in terms of political dynamic. There was another thing we really recognized, that in 2016, you know, his vote, a lot of his vote was people who didn't want to vote for Hillary. He was the alternative to Hillary. A lot of those voters were not with him ideologically necessarily and would drift to other candidates. But there was also a difference between a two-way race, which really existed from the start in 2016, because there were other candidates, but they were kind of non-factors. And the race that we were about to undertake, which we thought would be, and it ended up, over 20 candidates with 8 to 10 major players at any given time. So it was a completely different political dynamic that we had to think about.
Let me just say, Martin O'Malley would have won. but aside from that,
he was the best guitar player among the candidates.
But there also was a different, I mean, not only was there different expectations in 2020, there was also, I mean, I think Sanders entered into the race in 2016 and in 2020 with different expectations for what he was attempting to achieve, right?
Yeah, from Tim Tegaris, Bernie's online fundraiser, who did online fundraising in both 2016 and 2020, has a story. When Bernie went to him in 2016 and said, how much do you think I can raise? Tim said, I think if it goes really well, we could raise about $40 million in this race. And Bernie thought he was absolutely insane. There's like no way in hell I'm raising $40 million, right? And blew that out of proportion. In this race, we needed $40 million in the first 4 months, 5 months of the campaign. Like, there was no, that was not even a, like, we had that expectation right away. It was going to be something much bigger. And for Bernie, and I get into this in the book, that was a real challenge for him, because he's somebody who is used to a very tactile form of politics. He wants to see, touch, and feel. He doesn't like entourages. He wants small circles around him. He doesn't like a large staff. And, you know, he walked into campaign headquarters in April and saw a few hundred people and kind of lost his mind a little bit. And like, what do all these people do with their days? It's like, they're working for you. I actually had a conversation with Ben Cohn, the founder of Ben & Jerry's, who was one of our campaign co-chairs. And I said, what was it like for you going from, you know, making ice cream in a gas station to being one of the largest ice cream brands in the world? And he said, it was really hard. You know, I walked out of my office one day and I was a guy who was first making ice cream in my kitchen, and suddenly I have hundreds of people doing all sorts of jobs that I don't understand. And he's like, it was very difficult for me. And I asked that he have that conversation with Bernie, because Bernie was used to Vermont, where, you know, you can get in the car and drive anywhere and you can set up an event in an hour and say, hey, everybody come to, you know, the Veterans Hall and we'll have a conversation. Whereas, you know, you can't set up a 10,000 person rally in a few hours or even a day.
Let's talk about the way that policy was developed for the campaign in 2020, because it was pretty unique relative. I mean, I'm sure we can have historical precedents, or maybe you would be aware of them, but this was outside of the realm, at least in the modern day, There was a piece I read in the Washington Post. It was from in the ramp up to the campaign, talking about how the Sanders campaign rejected some of the more institutional Democratic policy feeders, if you will. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Look, I think with Bernie, there was a real, you know, the institutions of the Democratic Party, even some ones that are quote unquote liberal, really kind of did not like Bernie. And I tell a story in the book how we thought about policy in a lot of ways that happened in the lead up to the campaign. Bernie was in a huge fight with Jeff Bezos, which, by the way, is another example of Bernie being ahead of the Democratic Party. Most Democrats were like, oh, we love Jeff Bezos. And Bernie's like, that guy should pay his workers and treat them better. Right. And this was like 2017, 2018. And
now, you know, they're bragging about $15 minimum wage after the Stop Bezos Act, which was all Bernie forcing them to do that.
Well, that's what I was actually going to get to was, yeah. You know, we were meeting with Amazon workers. They were like, there's no way we're going to raise the minimum wage. And Bernie was like talking to Amazon workers, putting it up on our social media. Some of the videos were getting millions and millions of views. We knew the pressure was on. And Bernie put out a bill called the Stop Bezos Act. And it was a pure messaging bill at the time. You put out bills, you know, they're not going to get a vote in the House or Senate, but you want to set a message. And the message of the bill was that the point of the bill was, if your workers are on public assistance, you basically have to pay the government back for that public assistance, on the idea that companies like Amazon and McDonald's and Walmart, you know, when their workers are getting public housing, that's basically because they're not paying them enough. Every hamburger you buy at McDonald's is being subsidized by the fact that some of their workers are on public housing or on Medicaid or on all these public assistance programs because McDonald's doesn't pay them enough. And these big profitable corporations shouldn't rely on that government subsidy. That was the point. And the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which is a liberal institution in D.C., puts out a whole paper about how our bill was stupid and like it's a bad bill, da 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 da. And if you technically analyze the rates of the bill, da da da, right, this real egghead stuff for a bill that was like a messaging bill. And by the way, this was like in October. This was in the fall of 2018. When if you're like a Democratic institution and a liberal institution, perhaps there are more important things to be focused on than attacking Bernie Sanders. Perhaps if you're looking to attack somebody today, there are a bunch of Republican bills to attack. Also, this concept was politically popular, but what it did was all these mainstream Democratic, Warren Gunnels, Bernie's kind of longtime aide, attacked the Center on Budget Policy Priorities on Twitter, pointed out they were funded by Walmart, everybody, how dare you criticize them? And it created this moment where it basically, everyone started kind of like going against us on the Amazon wage thing because of this fight, at which point we're sitting there going, well, this is great. Like, you want to give us this lane ourselves? So when Amazon raises their wages, we get all the credit. You want to give us like the raising workers' wages lane all to our own? Like, gladly. And then they raise wages and then everybody, you know, then frankly, Bernie did get a bunch of the credit in the media because everybody gave us that lane. And I think we did approach policy that way. And I think we had a really brilliant policy team on the campaign led by Josh Orton and Billy Gendel and Warren Gunnels and a bunch of others who really looked at policy as a way, you know, policy on campaigns is less about writing a bill and passing a bill and more about what it says about your candidate and how it positions them. And I think we did a really good job of that. And I think after, frankly, let me state this, we did have a bit of a problem in the beginning of the campaign, somewhat because of candidate resistance, and I deal with this in the book, that allowed Elizabeth Warren, especially in the early months of the campaign, to take a lead on policy development, that we were ultimately able to kind of go back to our pre-campaign stride on.
Let's talk about the dynamic and the relationship with Elizabeth Warren, and which I think, you know, probably culminated in some level on the debate stage. I can't remember which debate it was.
Iowa in January, I believe.
Iowa in January. And, I mean, What's your perspective? What was your perspective, or what was the campaign's perspective going into it? And how did that change over the course of the campaign? And what is your perspective on it in retrospect?
Sure. There was a real divide on the campaign going in about whether she would be a strong candidate or a weak candidate. Bernie, interestingly, looking back in retrospect to everything that happened, always thought and always kind of scolded people who thought she would be a weak candidate. Always said she's a strong candidate, she's really smart, and she has the ability to win this race. And if she does win this race, you know, she can win. He thought he was a better candidate, no doubt. But he always, when other staff would kind of point out her weaknesses, he was always very like, no, stop. Like, you're really underestimating her. And, you know, what we saw is she launched as her campaign in late December. We had a very clear system for tracking almost on a day-to-day basis other candidates' online fundraising, especially at points where ActBlue was releasing a lot of data. So we were able to quickly see that her opening fundraising wasn't very good. You know, it was a few hundred thousand dollars, which that well below expectations, didn't show much momentum. She was coming off the very bad video she put out on the Native American issue, et cetera. We launched the campaign, but the thing we realized going back even a year before that, there was a meeting in my apartment where we met with Bernie before he decided to run. He was kind of resistant to even doing the meeting, but we're like, we need to start thinking about this, where we started developing strategy. And one of the things our research showed us was Bernie and Warren weren't the Venn diagram of voters that kind of was covered. Bernie Biden was a huge Venn diagram. Warren was a more Venn diagram. Our voters, basically, her voters were wealthier, had better education. Our voters, lower education, less wealthy, more people of color, actually, in our voter group, especially Latinos. And our voters and Joe Biden's voters looked much closer than Elizabeth Warren's voters and our voters. And so we were kind of going for two different groups in a way. And a lot of the campaign that allowed us to completely remain almost as allies. If you remember the Detroit debate, they kind of stood there and just took arrows and just like bucked them off from everybody on their policies. I think in terms of strategy, in terms of the development, I think there are a few key moments I address in the book. One is, right post heart attack is a really intriguing moment for us, because the day we had the heart attack that week, Warren goes ahead of Joe Biden for a very brief period in the polling. And Bernie slips to fourth place in Iowa behind Biden, Warren, Buttigieg, behind Biden, Warren, and Buttigieg, according to the Des Moines Register, that like gold standard and Setzer poll. At that point, we were supposed to go up on air with basically $1 million a week in advertising in Iowa. We paused it because of the heart attack, but the next week we went right back on air, and we're sitting there, and the only three candidates who really have money to go on TV are Warren, Bernie, and Buttigieg. Buttigieg is up on TV, but he's in a completely different kind of voter set. Warren doesn't go up on TV, and we're kind of waiting for her to go up on TV, because while our voters don't overlap, if she grows, there would be calls in the national media for Bernie to like step back for her. We were kind of more worried about a narrative issue than a voter issue. It would cap us at growing, because if she was growing, there'd be a narrative, oh, Bernie's done, Warren's right in. And one of the ways you do that is you kind of solidify yourself in Iowa. And as we're advertising at this heavy pace, our votes, like we're heading straight up, she's kind of flat and headed down, both nationally and in Iowa. And we're watching this and we're like, when is she going on TV? When is she going on TV? And she wasn't. And I frankly think that was a bad strategic choice on her campaign's part that frankly gave us a window to catch up. Then you get to kind of the Medicare for All moment, where Warren decides in November to adjust her position on Medicare for All. Her people would say improve. I go through in the book our strategy, which was built from 2017 for exactly this moment, where we basically created a strategy around Medicare for All, where we wanted as many people who were potentially running to sign onto the bill as possible, including Elizabeth Warren, who for a long time we were worried wasn't going to sign onto the bill. And I go into this in the book. about that dynamic between Bernie and Warren and our fear that she wasn't going to sign on to the bill. But once you signed on, you were kind of committed to the bill. And what we realized is, based on something, frankly, Grover Norquist once told me. I know that's a weird I went to the J Street dinner, and Grover
Norquist, head of Club for Growth.
The Americans for Tax Reform.
Okay.
The principal conservative activist behind, like, being the tax pledge was his big thing. And he was at the J Street dinner, and I was seated next to him. And the first thing he did, it's one of those Washington dinners where they put the dessert in front of you on the table before the meal. And he sits down, he grabs the dessert, and he starts eating it. And I'm like, you eat the dessert? And he's like, what if there's a fire alarm there? And then I can't, and then I don't get dessert. It's like, that's actually a good point from Grover Norquist. I appreciate that. But the strategic point was, I started quizzing him on the tax pledge, which, you know, became religion in the Republican Party. I will not raise taxes ever. And I was like, how do you enforce that? And he was like, it's self-enforcing. Once you sign, if you violate it, the activists are going to kill you. I get to raise all the money, and I don't have to spend a dollar enforcing it. Medicare for All, same concept. Once you sign, the Medicare for All activist community will be the enforcers. And the one of the things that, by the way, they were most strict about on the activist side was the implementation period. And that's what Elizabeth Warren touched. And you touch that rail with those activists, they're going to go nuts. And I think she expressed anger eventually that activists were really beating her up, blaming our campaign for it. But frankly, we didn't direct that. But we didn't direct that. We knew it would happen if you did it. But we don't control those activists. And those activists, frankly, had protested Bernie at times for not being good enough on it. And I think doing that, making those changes late in the campaign, really did hurt her. And then you get to the night you're talking about, the debate night, where before the debate, their campaign, because certainly there were three people in the room who witnessed this conversation, and certainly our campaign didn't leak it to CNN. There's a story on CNN that four sources, which is always interesting because there were three people in the room, one of which clearly wasn't a source. Four sources say Bernie said that a woman can't be president during a meeting with Elizabeth Warren. I think, you know, that exploded on the debate stage. Honestly, it was an interesting part of the book to write, because I had to put it in, right? I had to write about it. I couldn't, like, skip that part. It's a very difficult part to write because I want to express my opinion, which I do wholeheartedly, but, you know, you want to see the moment for what it is. And in my opinion, which is in the book very clearly, I had been with Bernie for 1,000 meals. I've heard his opinions on everything. I've heard his opinion on Elizabeth Warren. I've heard his opinion on Donald Trump. I've definitely heard his opinion on what it takes in 2020. And I've heard his opinions on different candidates. Can they win? Should they win? I never heard anything like that. Yeah. In fact, I constantly heard the opposite, which was Elizabeth Warren's a strong candidate who I think I'm a better candidate for a number of reasons, but I think she's a strong candidate. And I think she can do very well in this race. So it was shocking to me. And look, who knows what happened? As I said, there were three people in the room, and people can have very different interpretations of conversations. So I don't necessarily think anybody is quote unquote lying. I do think I just had never heard Bernie say anything like that, nor do I believe he believed that.
Yeah. Like, well, let's put aside the question of whether he said it or not. Okay. Right. I mean, as a political matter, right? Yeah. I mean, because this is being deployed as a political matter. It's either true or it's not. You know, my guess is maybe somebody said something and somebody heard it in a different way, whatever. It doesn't really matter. The question is from a political, in terms of its deployment politically.
Yeah.
What do you think they were trying to achieve? And what were you guys feeling afterwards? Because from my perspective at the time, and I was, you know, I obviously I was supportive of Bernie, and I wanted Bernie to win, but I definitely was supportive in some sense of Elizabeth Warren, not necessarily, you know, to win in this race, but in general, I was disappointed by the sort of like the way that she did politics, because I feel like this was a missed opportunity for her in the way that she responded to that CNN story, which could have been, I'm not going to talk about what I discuss in a private meeting with an ally.
That and CNN story was, that, but well, Sam, they, that CNN story was probably her camp.
Well, no, definitely. Whether it was her camp or not, she had an opportunity to respond that way. You know, very often your camp will say one thing and you as a candidate will say another. She could have had the opportunity to say, I'm going to have my cake and eat it too.
I can't speak to their strategy. I can tell you what it did. I think the first thing that it did was it really balkanized Bernie and Elizabeth Warren supporters, because while there was no Venn diagram if they were in the race, if one had left the race, there was certainly a look on certain portions of their candidates to the other side. What you saw after, because we were polling second choice, because Iowa in the caucuses, if you don't reach threshold, you get second choice. So we were polling second choice, and you know, you saw the second choice votes on both of those sides just plummet. You saw Bernie's support among women decrease. You saw some other dynamics take place. And I think you saw that was kind of the net effect of that, which clearly was not, you know, was not.
Why would they do? They have the same Venn diagram that you have. Right. So why do that?
I honestly to this day don't know fully what they decided to do and why they decided to do it. And we also don't know who did it in their camp
right.
Who did, and that would very much like, obviously her camp had to be part of it, because somebody would actually have to confirm it who was in the room. So, or CNN's not going to drop a bombshell like that without somebody in the room confirming it. Their camp had to be a part of it. I can't look, I've always, maybe it's a problem with my media appearances in life, but I've always avoided talking about the motivations of others that I really don't know. And in this case, I really don't know.
Okay. But that's the question, right? Is she, you had internal polling data, to Sam's point, that indicated that it was more between Biden and Bernie. And for some reason, she felt it was necessary to undercut Bernie and differentiate herself, even though she was, or get some of his support, maybe because she was maxing out with the, you know,
If that was the rationale, it would be a bad idea, because an attack like that, I mean, without any polling data, you know, if there are 10 candidates in the race and candidate B attacks candidate A in the way candidate A loses support, candidate A supporters are not going to drift to the candidate who just
necessarily. Right. Yeah, of course. All right. So let me ask you this. In the one other like sort of point. How much did the candidate did the campaign hope that Warren sometime before Super Tuesday or after Super Tuesday would endorse Bernie? Because that to me also seemed to be a miscalculation by the Warren campaign, at least insofar as her value was to deliver presumably to Biden or to whomever. Like if she wanted to be vice president, she either endorses Bernie wins, and maybe that helps her getting a vice presidency, or she wants to be Biden's vice president, in which case, had she endorsed Bernie, she would have been able to deliver, theoretically, Bernie voters.
I tend to agree with your rationale. Like, you know, Bernie voters, our voter base tends not to like her because they see her in both 2016 and 2020 at critical moments not supporting Bernie. I think for us, the important part of her endorsement wasn't so much supporters, but the narrative in the media at, you know, post Super Tuesday was, you know, Biden, all the support of the Democratic Party is gathering around Biden. Everybody's gathering around Biden. And the hope of that endorsement was not that there was a lot of voters that were Elizabeth Warren voters at that point. There just weren't that many voters that were Elizabeth Warren voters. The hope of that endorsement, or that she would sway those voters in one direction or the other, but the kind of national media narrative, which was so important in this race, was Biden's coalescing the entire Democratic Party, everyone supporting Biden, and an Elizabeth Warren endorsement would have kind of stopped, would have been a little bit of a stopper in that narrative. And, you know, in a way that, you know, for example, the Jesse Jackson endorsement before Michigan wasn't, but was important to Bernie on a very personal level and important among among the African-American community, it was an important endorsement. But an Elizabeth Warren endorsement would have signified that kind of the political world is not coalescing, and that it didn't happen, was not the best thing for the campaign.
All right. So let me ask you this, and maybe I have two major questions to ask, and let's start with the more negative. Like, from a campaign perspective, at the end of the campaign, was there a sense, and obviously things got complicated because of COVID, although it's arguable as to whether things were 95% over at that point, or 90% over, or 85% over, or 100% over. I mean, it's unclear. But was there any one major strategic decision that you guys on the campaign felt, if we had to make that choice again, we would do it differently?
Look, I think there is a number of people who... I don't think the strategic choices in February and March are the thing you have to look at, right? I think February and March get set up a long time before. Right. And the strategic choice you have to look at, and I go into this in detail in the book, the kind of the scene of it, where prepping for the September debate, Bernie was prepped and Bernie agreed to kind of go on stage and attack Joe Biden. And in the green room before the debate, Faz and I, who were in the green room, saw him change his mind, where I, to the point where, like, when he walked out of the green room to walk to the stage, I turned to Faz. I was like, do you think he's going to do it? And there was kind of a, and he walked out on stage, and in his opening statement, instead of doing the kind of this attack that we had talked about in prep that he had actually practiced, and he had actually practiced it in the green room before the debate. And I set the scene, and people can read the story in detail about literally what happened, where you saw his mind change. He went out and delivered what I would call the Bernifesto, right? The Medicare for all, college for, like, his popular and good, but not going to make any news and not going to change the format. And so instead of that opening being everyone saying nice things and policy agenda, and then Bernie getting up and basically starting an attack on Joe Biden, it was different. Now, you could argue that attack would have been dangerous and would have created problems, but it also changes the dynamic of the race. And the question is, if you don't, candidates don't typically walk off a cliff. You have to push them. And if you don't, if you left Biden as a credible candidate, we knew from the start of this race that if Super Tuesday was a one-on-one match between Bernie and Biden, Bernie would lose.
Well, I was there. I was at the, the Super Tuesday kind of red wedding situation, and the speech that Bernie gave in the wake of those results, which were very disappointing. And it was shocking to me how aggressively he went after Biden in that speech, by my recollection, in the wake of the Super Tuesday results. So I hope I'm not mixing up which speeches I saw during that election period, because it's all a bit of a haze, but I think that's what it was. So do you perceive that as being a little bit too late when he did after Biden?
I think once Super Tuesday happens, the Democratic Party wanted a candidate to go up against Trump. And once they saw a candidate emerge on Super Tuesday that was Joe Biden, it wasn't over, but it was going to be very difficult with the system of proportional allocation of delegates and other things to catch up ever. And we knew, and the same thing, we knew if we could come out of Super Tuesday with 150 to 200 delegate lead, it would likely, the only way they could beat Bernie Sanders at that point was by kind of destroying the Democratic Party. If he had had that lead, like, they could blow up the party or they could just have Bernie Sanders as the nominee. But we'd need to get there. And the fact is, if Joe Biden had the delegate lead, it was going to be very, very difficult. It wasn't impossible, but it was going to be very difficult to turn the momentum, because there was such a strong force among the party. And what we saw after South Carolina was $70+ million in free media. This study was done by the Cantor Media people, $70 million in free media directed at promoting Joe Biden or attacking Bernie Sanders in the 48 hours between South Carolina and Super Tuesday, which is unprecedented.
All right, let's just turn. I want to talk about the legacy of these two campaigns. But I want to introduce that idea. Let's play this clip. How long of a clip do we have here? Clip number two. This is Bernie. Five days ago, talking to some Starbucks employees in Richmond, Virginia. It's one of the things the campaign did that I think had some controversy associated with it in terms of like a campaign assessment, that they used the campaign, the resources of the campaign, to bolster worker actions and strength through the campaign in a way that, at least, you know, in modern times, we've not seen. Here's Bernie addressing some Starbucks workers.
Can you afford the health care that they give you?
No.
All right. So understand, I want you to understand this, because this is the bullshit that corporations often do. What they say to the public, McDonald's does it as well, Walmart does it. They say, we're really generous. We are offering health care. We have this, we have that. And you look at the figures, nobody takes it because they can't afford. You understand that that is a bad situation. Anybody can walk across the street, get hit by a bus. You have friends who have been diagnosed with serious illnesses, right? It can happen to anybody.
I rejoined Starbucks in July last year when I moved to Richmond. And then in late August, I was diagnosed with cancer.
Okay.
And so I had no choice but to work full-time hours at Starbucks to avoid health insurance so that I could get chemotherapy.
Oh my
and
God.
All my medications. So I'm working at least 30 hours a week. I'm chemo sick.
What is your name?
My name is TJ.
TJ?
All right. Thank God I had my last treatment in January.
Okay. So, first off, there, you know, I'm struck in that scene just the idea that, I mean, he's continuing, and this is what he did during the campaign.
And he's done his entire career, right? This is quintessential Bernie Sanders.
And it's also, it's young people. There is a growing awareness amongst younger people of a different sort of like, you know, expectations of politics that, you know, we could see it start, you know, coming out of Occupy, but it really coalesced in 2015 around Bernie. The idea of you know, money and politics, and that's where we started to see some actual class consciousness return to our politics. Just give me a sense of like the campaign's legacy. How much of that carries on beyond and outside of Bernie?
Look, I think one of Bernie's points was you can't just win the election. We need a movement of workers in this country to carry through our agenda, right? So part of the campaign had to be, how do you create that movement of workers? How do you make the struggles of workers eat as a part of the struggles of the campaign? It's why during the campaign, we went to the Walmart shareholder meeting, right? And Bernie spoke at the Walmart shareholder meeting and rallied workers outside. That wasn't because Bentonville, Arkansas is like a hotbed of, you know, delegates for the Democratic Party. It was because Bernie thought that labor organizing was an intrinsic part of the campaign. And I think you see as a lasting impact, I think in this country, you see a rise in young people's recognition of unions, the power of unions, and what unions can mean. And I do think part of that credit goes to Bernie Sanders for really bringing a culture of labor organizing to politics. And look, not all the credit. I think the people organizing, the Chris Smalls, deserve the bulk of the credit, right? But Bernie really wanted to bring that level of class consciousness and the idea that unions can help you in these workplaces to politics. And this isn't just about winning an election in the White House. This might also be about winning an election in your workplace.
All right. So lastly, 2024, what do you know? What do you hear? I know you hear things.
Yeah, nothing.
I know you hear things. Come on.
Here's what I know. Bernie himself is an unstoppable force. And, you know, the memo that got sent out that became a whole rigmarole last week said, you know, if Joe Biden doesn't run, which is a big if, and I, frankly, if you ask me, you know, I'm a betting man. So if you ask me to take a bet, I'd bet on the Joe Biden running side again. just because I think that's the most likely. But if Joe Biden doesn't run, he's not taking himself out of the race in that case. When I wrote the book, truthfully, and you can tell in the tone, I didn't think Bernie was going to run another race. But if Bernie says he would think about doing it, look, you showed the video of him in Richmond. Earlier that day, he was on Staten Island with Amazon workers. 2 days ago, he's protesting outside the White House for student debt relief. Bernie is kind of he's got an inhuman amount of energy. And I believe if he says he can do it, he would at least think about it. Like, I fully believe that. Frankly, too much for me. I don't have the energy for it. I'll tell you that much.
All right. One more question. I
lied. That's on a personal level. I mean, I wouldn't have the energy to work on a campaign like that again.
I understand. One more question. I lied that one was the last one. Has Bernie changed his philosophy or approach in working within the system, particularly the Democratic Party? And if so, why?
I don't think he's changed his approach. He's always been a person from the time, look how he governed as mayor. He, won, the city council opposed him. He kind of had a fight with the city council for 2 years and then spent 6 years successfully governing the city. In the House, he passed amendment after amendment after amendment, and you don't do that without working with your colleagues. In the Senate, he and John McCain negotiated the largest veterans bill, one of the largest veterans bills in this country's history. And then you take that to the beginning of 2021, and Bernie Sanders is the person responsible for a $1.7 trillion reconciliation package, one of the largest in our country's history. And that was an incredibly complex bill that I was kind of the capstone to my Senate career working on that bill, where you were talking about policies across the board that really made a difference in people's lives. And I think Bernie is a guy who very much can get out on the campaign trail, fight, and then sit down at the table and work. And I think I'm going to be honest. One of the mistakes Democrats often make is they bargain in public, like they soften their rhetoric. And then by the time you get to the bargaining table, they have to bargain 10 more times. Bernie will go to the bargaining table. He's done it on bills, but he doesn't pre-negotiate ever. And that's the difference with Bernie. He's not going to pre-negotiate with you. He'll bargain when it's time to bargain, but he's not going to pre-do it.
All right, Rabenhoff, the book, I had so many other things I wanted to talk to you about, but we have sadly run out of time. We're going to have you back soon. The book is called The Fighting Soul, On the Road with Bernie Sanders. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Great to see you.
Thank you for having me, Sam and Emma.
Thanks so much, Ari.
All right, folks. Now it is time. Do we have him? Can we bring...
second. We'll bring him in.
That made me nostalgic, but I just got to say.
I honestly forgot about the heart attack entirely.
Bittersweet. I mean, that was the impetus for AOC's endorsement, basically.
Yep.
I mean,
yeah, right.
And that whole rally there, that was an amazing day. It was like the most beautiful day in October. I'll never forget that. But.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, the next song
Give
you
us
will
one
hear.
One second, Sam.
Yeah, we okay. just need a little bit.
Maybe the song can play while we do that. Mm. This song signifies the appearance of our next guest. Oh, Emma. Casting things on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe I'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie. All right, drop them in anytime. There you go. Matthew, film time. And. Matt, what is going on with your sound?
I don't know. You tell me what to do.
What are you speaking? Are you speaking through a microphone or like do you have an air conditioner going on in there or what?
Yeah, hold on. I'll kill that. This setup has less muting ability. Hello.
Hello,
hey, Matthew. And we should say this is the first time that we're seeing you since the live show. Is that right?
That is correct. That is correct. And had a great time on the live show. Indeed.
And behind you is one of the versions of the gift that you gave me there, which was a picture that you, a little Photoshop job you did of me, presumably interviewing meme Bernie Sanders.
That's right. If you recall the meme craze that swept the nation after the inauguration, Bernie Sanders in his mittens. And, you know, I did a slew of them and I figured, you know what? Why don't I put Sam in a compromising position with Bernie Sanders?
Why was I compromising?
You're right. That's not the one I made a frame for and hung on the wall. I made this one too. I was just thinking, you know, it wouldn't be complete. You know, we should actually have asked Ari, maybe we can get Bernie to sign it too. That would really make it valuable.
I all right, fair enough. That's great. It's you've always working an angle, Matthew. I'm very pleased to hear that.
I mean, look, I don't, now that I'm in Hollywood and firmly established as a famous film editor, I don't need the money that I used to from eBay. But, you know, I still haven't decided what exactly we should do with this. I was thinking maybe, I don't know, just floating this, it could be a door prize at the Boston show. I don't know, whatever it could help the show to do to achieve. You know, I know you guys have been going through a little bit of a downturn, the whole advertising thing. And I just want to say, in light of that, I am going to be waiving my usual appearance fee here today. So,
oh, well, thank you very much. It's very generous of you.
Speaking
of your Hollywood career, what's the latest? What are you working on now?
Well, I just finished this horror movie that you've heard me talk about a few times, and it's in post-production right now. It was quite an interesting experience, I must say. The director I worked with was extremely awesome, very talented, nice guy, but the production did have a little bit of drama to it, which I don't think I can talk about just quite yet, but well, let's just put it this way. Sam, have you ever
do that? You can't come on the show and say like, oh, I've got a great story. Yeah, I can't tell it.
This is how I ensure future appearances. You know, I know I'm not your first thought every Friday, but I'll just tell you this. There was some sort of internecine sort of arguments between the various producers on the film as to whether or not we were making sort of like an A24 prestige horror, or we were making like a quickie straight to video Netflix kind of crap, you know, low grade horror movie. And the director had already always pitched it to me as a little bit more intelligent than your average sort of schlocky horror movie. But apparently two of the producers disagreed with one of them, and hilarity ensued. I don't know if you've ever worked on a movie, Sam, where, not naming any names, but one of the producers hired his own wife to edit the movie without telling the director. And then once the director saw the assembly that that person made and rejected it and decided to hire his own editor, continued to have his wife edit the movie as a sort of shadow editor all throughout the production. And every time there were notes, would always refer back to his wife's cut, like, well, she did it like this, she did it like that, only to find out in the end, he had surreptitiously, after months of work between the director and the editor, slipped this movie into the distributor's post-production pipeline and attempted to sort of Game of Thrones Bigfoot all the work that the director had actually done. It all turned out well in the end. But my goodness, I had never heard of that one before.
So wait a second. If I understand what you're saying, there was editing one version and there was a shadow editing going on. Yeah. No, I've experienced that multiple times.
You have?
Oh, of course.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
On both ends. On both ends of that.
Oh, you have been the shadow. You've been the shadow.
I've been the shadow and the non-shadow.
All right. Well, you never told me about that one.
I will tell you right now. I would not be surprised to find out if there was a separate Majority Report that was actually being piped out right now that is, you know, significantly different, where it's Emma is like doing like the, you know, is asking you the question right now.
Cut the feed.
I was about to say. Yeah.
You know, I thought that's what was happening last week, but then it turns out, no, you just got COVID.
Wait, you were on last week?
No, I wasn't. I'm just saying I just thought it was this alternate world that I somehow
The Emma cut goes out.
Yes. Yeah, the Emma Jardy report.
We had a plan, actually, when we got the new board, because we can output multiple different outputs At one point, we put out a version of the show one day that just you couldn't hear Michael.
Yeah, people used to always complain about Michael, and then we say, well, we have a new board that we can just do it where it doesn't put his mic to the output.
Yeah, and we never ended up producing that
what
one.
What would they complain about? Like, what? Him just, like, making comments?
Cackling.
I can't really even remember, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember. There was just one listener, and we were just going to send that listener, like, their own feed. If they, like a super level no Michael comment
instead of Right Wing Mandela, it's just silence for like
exactly. We're just laughing at
suddenly the room just explodes in laughter.
Well, congratulations both on the finishing of the editing and it sounds like winning the battle of the edits.
Yeah, it does seem like that, but until I see it like premiere and stream and like my name is there as the editor, I'm not going to be completely secure.
Yeah, that I wonder what would happen. Would you get editing credit?
Oh, well, you know, honestly, to go totally inside baseball, my agent always said at the beginning, like, he's not sharing credit. If he takes this job, it's, you know, either all credit or he's taking his name off of it. So, you know, we'll see what that comes down to. I certainly did this not for the prestige or the money, but, you know, to build my credits towards getting better films. So hopefully that is the outcome. But it may be, I don't know, an additional editor for this other person. Listen, it's out of my hands at this point. So I'm just glad that we got the version of the film that we put together out there into the world, you know, obviously with compromises and notes from the producers and so on. But at least it was not as bad as this sort of reality TV version of the movie.
All right, one more question for you before we get to the meat of the heart of the matter. What's next? Like, that's old news.
I know, right? I've been fielding offers, but I'm taking
fielding offers.
Yeah, of course. So, right. You know, I've turned a few things down that I didn't think were quite the right fit.
Wow,
for me.
Wow, you're a 5-star recruit.
I mean, you know, I'm not getting offers these huge movies, but I am looking for something that's. Thank you. Thank you, Soundboard. You know, I have a friend who's putting together a kind of a bigger budget studio movie that I may have an in with. So I'm sort of holding out for that. Meanwhile, I'm reading scripts and considering my options. So, and in the meantime, enjoying teaching my amazing online film appreciation class, which I hope Bradley's putting the link in the description. But okay, great. And doing my thing, you know, might be actually going to Disney World for my mother's birthday coming up in the month.
What?
Well, it's familial obligation. I'm going to see all my family haven't seen them in 2 years.
Why is your mother going to Disney World? Is she a Disney adult?
I mean, I think she thinks that all of her kids are, and it's been, you know, it was like a family vacation spot back in our youth. So it's some place that she thought she could, you know, entice us all to show up for. And, you know, what do you know? It'll work.
Sam's going to ask Mylon Saul to do that when they're when
he turns 70.
Right? You
know? That's only 2 years.
For your 80th,
can we stay in the same pirate theme room and share a bed? If Saul and I will share a bed again.
Yeah, that would be great.
Oh my God.
You'll love that.
I got to make that video of my time at Disney World. God, what a nightmare. I mean, Saul really enjoyed it, but.
Yeah. Yeah, well, but who cares about that?
I mean, good luck, buddy. I have your mom call me if you.
Thank you, Emma.
Now you realize you go to Disney, your mom is bringing you down there essentially to get groomed, right?
Yeah, yeah, essentially.
I mean,
she's constantly told me I would love you no matter what, no matter who you are. And what you like, but I, you know, I think it's getting a little.
But
more
I'd love you more if you were gay, right?
But I would love you more if you were gay. Listen, I had three sisters growing up, so my underwear was continually referred to as panties, and I had to really draw a line there. But you know, nobody likes their underwear misgendered.
I don't think that word is like most women. I don't think like that word either. But that's a whole separate conversation.
Good.
Now
good
the thing
to know.
Is, at Disney, if you agree, if you sign up when you get the package, at that time, if you agree to get groomed, they let you in the park an extra 15 minutes early.
Wow.
Yeah. So you get better. Better position in the line.
Yeah,
right there.
I bet.
Pray hours.
Yeah. So you, it's definitely worth it. It's definitely worth it too. If you're like, want to see the Star Wars, the top Star Wars rides, you agree to get groomed prior to going. Cause you cannot agree to get groomed day of. They won't, they don't work that way. It doesn't work.
You have to reserve the grooming session.
There's a lot of like Byzantine rules. And
I will sign up to the, I will sign up
the grooming package.
Yeah. Molested by Darth Vader.
Matthew Film Guy.
Yes.
Let's earn your moniker, shall we? What should we stream? I should tell you that during COVID, I streamed like, I watched like 40 episodes of Mad Men, and it was disturbing on multiple ways. It's a great show, but it was really disturbing.
Why?
It is not, well, it's a very,
it's heady, my favorite show ever. I will put that out.
Oh,
there.
It's no, it's one of my top shows too, but it really, you know, when I watched it back in 2007 and nine and this and that, you know, it's an intense show. And to watch, to have no contact with people and be immersed in that world is pretty intense.
Were you drinking bourbon or whatever they're drinking the whole time?
I'll tell you something. I was like, I haven't like contemplated sitting in my, on my couch smoking a cigarette in, I don't know, 25 years. And I was like, yeah. I need a cigarette and some
trigger alert.
And meanwhile, I'm like, I can barely breathe. I've got a fever. And like, it was pretty intense.
Yeah. Mary and I just did a full rewatch of Breaking Bad, and I have never wanted crystal meth more than ever.
Of course. Yeah.
Because it made it look so good.
So fun.
But you can't get that blue stuff around here, so it doesn't matter.
All right. So with that said, Matthew Film Guy, what should we stream this weekend?
Well, as you know, I show these kind of pretty difficult but interesting and rewarding and soul-searing films in my online adult film appreciation class. And we recently saw a few. So, you know, thanks to inflation, I actually have three movies to recommend this week.
Whoa.
Because they're all, we see so many great movies that are always so mind-blowing and so exciting. I just want to throw them all out there for the collective Majority Report audience to enjoy. The first one is by Thai filmmaker, I think I may have mentioned him before, named A Pitch at Pong Weerasethakul. Sam, please hold the coughing down while I'm
sorry.
That's okay. I'm sorry you got sick. Second, Syndromes and a Century is the name of the movie.
What was the name of the first movie?
Well, I was saying the director's name, which is a mouthful. A Pitch at Pong, Weerasethakul. He's a Thai filmmaker, and he's become one of my favorites thanks to seeing all of his movies in this class. But his 2006 movie called Syndromes and a Century, it probably is so far my favorite of all of his, but I'm watching them in order. It's basically sort of like a two-part kind of reminiscence of the two parts of his life, both in the countryside of Thailand and in the city where his parents were doctors. One was a doctor in a rural hospital, and one was in a sort of a, you know, modern sort of bustling corporate hospital. And it's just, it's poetic, it's dramatic, it's never less than completely engaging. They sort of are flip sides of the same story. So it's sort of like a repeat of some of the similar narrative elements in part one or happen in part two. It's a mind blower, it's a mind fucker, and it's really touching. And that was like a 5-star film for me. So
like
Syndrome.
Black Bear.
Black Bear is also a 5-star film for me. Is that what you're asking?
I mean, having the two stories and the...
Well, see, here's what's interesting, Sam. I'm glad you brought that up. It did remind me of Hong Sang-soo. And Hong Sang-soo, the Korean filmmaker who I've mentioned before, he was definitely a spiritual inspiration for Black Bear. Larry wrote that. And Larry was the one who turned me on to Hong Sang-soo. So if I ever met A Pitch at Pong Weerasethakul, I'd ask him if he was in any way influenced by Hong Sang-soo. Which, you know, they're contemporaries. So that is a good call, Sam. It is in some ways like that, yeah.
Hopefully somebody in that opportunity to ask will ask.
Yeah.
All right, number two.
Also, I want to recommend another movie by the British filmmaker Joanna Hogg. It's her second to most recent one called The Souvenir. And this one's probably a little bit more accessible to the Majority Report listening audience. It's kind of a story, a romantic comedy, but done in a very sort of abstract and sort of you might call it a ambient way. And it's sort of on the backdrop of IRA violence in the 1980s in England, but it's a girl becomes a film student. It's sort of autobiographical about Joanna Hogg, and she falls in love with a man who has some secrets. I don't want to spoil too much for you. And it's just told in a really arresting and original style. It's probably my least favorite of all of her movies, but I just thought it was an amazing movie. Her other movies are Unrelated, Archipelago, and Exhibition. All of them I can recommend. Those don't count to my three.
Okay.
And the last one is actually the most controversial one in this class. It brought up a lot of really interesting conflicts and debates. It's a Luchino Visconti movie called Rocco and His Brothers. Have you ever seen that one, Sam? It's no. Kind of like a pretty well-known Criterion Collection movie. But that's more, Luchino Visconti was a sort of a gay Marxist Italian neorealist at the beginning. And by the time he made Rocco and His Brothers in the 60s, he had become a little bit more, he was shooting on sets and shooting in, kind of a more classical style. But it still had this element of sort of a socio-political sort of germ of an idea. It's basically about a Southern Italian family who leave the poverty of their kind of rural life and move up to the big city in the north in Milan, and they meet with sort of prejudice. They're sort of like an underclass, and they kind of struggle with these vicissitudes of working and living in a big city, and they adapt in different ways. And it has some pretty, disturbing sort of violence, some sexual violence. And one of the things they struggle with is sort of the patriarchal values that they bring with them to the city. And it's pretty a harsh condemnation of those values, but to witness them was pretty disturbing. But in the end, it's a really moving and I think insightful movie. And Luchino Visconti is one of my favorites of all the Italians. So Wow. Give him that one.
So we got bonus films this week, folks. We got Syndromes and Sentry, Souvenir, a cool rom-com, according to Matthew, and Hardy. Rocco and His Brothers, classic Criterion. Matthew Film Guy, on behalf of Emma Vigeland, let me say adieu and thank you so much for coming on today.
Emma, always glad to be here, Sam.
All right, thank you.
Take care.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member of the Majority Report today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget Just Coffee. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And we have merch. What is it at? Majority? I can't remember anything now. Shop.MajorityReportRadio.com.
Yeah.
But there's also a website, and I can't even remember what it is. I mean, we have a URL, but it's shop.MajorityReportRadio.com. Check out our merch, folks. We got all sorts of cool stuff over there. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Well, so last night we had a members only, $10 and up members only Zoom for patreon.com/leftreckoning subscribers, where we had a couple of Australian listeners. We had about 10 people on there, two from Australia, Kowalski live from the field where he was planting corn.
Oh, awesome.
And so we had a really fun. I was drinking Eagle Rare Kentucky bourbon yesterday.
Oh, that's a good bourbon.
And I was a little bit intoxicated by about 9 p.m. and fell asleep. for this weekend, Griscom and I, for patrons, are doing Marx's thesis on Feuerbach, a little reading primer for that as we work through Marx's early writings before Capital.
Fantastic. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. And see you there. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Unhappy. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unhappy. Matt.
Who?
Unhappy.
What is up, everyone?
Unhappy. Nomi Key.
You did it.
Unhappy.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unhappy. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go throw up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.